Okay. Well, we begin our last week, and I've been thinking over the weekend about conclusion. First, your feedback from last week. It was uniform in a quite remarkable way. You liked the presentation of projects. You liked talking about them. You wished that we'd gotten to it sooner. You liked the question tool, although you could see some distraction. That was basically it. There was one feedback memo from the week before that's been nagging at me. They were all very supportive, but one said, "I've learned a lot, but it's slowed down. I'm looking for something bigger. What have you got?" I've been thinking about that. And as we come to a conclusion, I'm feeling like somehow that question is right immediately on the table. The biggest thing I've got, as far as I can tell, is a thought about law. I'm doing a little Fred Friendly panel later this week, on which I'm hoping to follow the odyssey of someone who comes here as a student and confronts the issue of laptop in the classroom as a way of opening up the question of the relationship between education and technology, law and technology. And then move on to the young associate who faces the technology in the form of massive discovery that the law firms are doing and the life that young associates are leading looking at laptops. And then on, I think, to the level of teacher, where questions are in issue about whether there needs to be some rethinking of the orientation of law to the rest of society in relationship to the new tech environment. And then maybe if there's time, but I doubt there will be, on to the level of the university. What should the university's role be in the environment? Or what could it be? And at the core of this thought of mine is that law is actually in really bad shape in many respects. I felt it acutely this morning when I read the New York Times. Upper left part of the front page describes the Padilla video. The New York Times obviously has had a reporter watch this video, and they give you a blow-by-blow description of it. To me, it sounded just like our waterboarding video in just a different form. One form difference being that this was for real. This wasn't a constructed thing. And it was so extraordinary to me to read this and understand that this is an American citizen who was held incommunicado without being able to see a lawyer for 21 months and treated in the way is depicted in this video. and that we more or less have been trained to sit back and think that that's an okay relationship of an American citizen to the American state. So to come back to the idea of law, the most fundamental thought is that in some deep sense, we are the law. You are the law. You come to law school in part because you feel something draw you to the law. There's some positive attraction to the notion of truth and justice and the idea that somehow you can make a life in quest of it. So one of the most fundamental things I think that the technological environment has to offer law is its process of algorithmic thinking. And we started with Scratch. Code is law. Law is code. You come to Harvard Law School, you learn process. Process is the program that the law runs on. The very same elements that seem so central to programming, that is, of elegance and efficiency and just running code, should be central to law. Second feature that this technological environment offers us. The tech environment is built on zeros and ones. Zero, one. Imagine an environment in which, whoop, that's all there is. And think of it as the truth domain. The truth domain is like zero, one. There's truth, there's not truth. People argue about what truth is. It's obviously multiple visions of it. The idea that there's one truth, a kind of religious notion. The idea that there are multiple truths, like the Necker cube. The law, in a really fundamental way, creates a process it puts its faith in for finding truth, as opposed to a process that is in direct touch with truth. And that leads you to a thought about how law should work. If it works like an elegant machine, it doesn't have somebody running it at each one of the nodes, putting a skew on it in order to produce the truth that that person at the node sees. You're looking for a kind of neutral process. Wechsler, back in the last century, articulates the idea of neutral principles, the idea of neutrality in law. But one of the interesting things I think that the technology offers us is that where neutrality would seem to be a kind of a bloodless thing, you know, you can go either way. In a connected environment, that's not so true. In a connected environment where people's sense of truth can actually combine, you can get something very positive. And what's the most powerful idea in the programming world? It's this element of recursion. Recursion, as we see it in what we're trying to do, is learning about learning. Learning to do something, but learning how you learn to do something, so that It keeps going. We're coming to the end here. The end in the sense of the official credit for what's being done running out. But the whole idea of learning has to do with making a passage from apprentice to master. The idea when you're learning something is you learn how to do it, you're a student. But there comes a moment when you pass from being the student to actually being the it. And that's what you're looking for. That's the graduation. That's what's supposed to happen at the end of the course. Not that you close it, leave it, put it away, but that you take it and own it and use it. And I'm feeling very much in this class like there are things that you have embarked upon which you may want to continue. I know my feeling is very much that. I feel like we embarked. Rebecca went into Second Life and she's embarked. And far from it ending this week, it seems much more to me to be a platform to move from. So I've been full of thoughts about my winter evidence class, wanting somehow to build on the base that we have explored and established to some extent here. So a few things to catch up. First, can we point out over here under audiences law the final project assignment? And you'll see it nicely described with the due date December 7th. Mary Weld has just asked me, predicating her request on the fact that, where can I log in here? Okay. Predicating her request on the fact that the web space just came up recently for an extension of December 7th through the weekend. Is that something that people would desire? Or would you rather I kept it flat at December 7th?
Weekend.
Weekend. Okay. So it's now due date Monday, December 11th. Any particular time of day? 5 p.m. End of business. December 11th. Okay, good. And Becca has a podcast that she is eager to play for you, which in some sense has this quality of recursion, this idea of feeding back and having the energy that you create become the input for something that makes something more. It's like that form of energy input that makes the engine go. Do you want to play the podcast? Any background you want to offer to this, or just let her...
Sandy, and this is Jeff.
We're from different coasts and probably different generations. We met in Cyber One. I've been a librarian and a teacher in a community college for 6 years. And what is so exciting about the idea of open access to education from the great universities is the possibility that thinking may catch on as a form of recreation. When you talk to people who love to learn, most of them had one, at least one, transformative teacher. But traditionally, great teachers had a limit on what they could do. Picture this. Every great teacher you've ever heard about videotapes their lectures and offers them up. Anyone can listen, catch fire, pop in to Second Life, and meet the other students who are also on fire, talk to the discussion leader, and then get a shot at interaction a few times a semester in Second Life with this great teacher. It boggles the mind.
This is Jeff. I'm a PhD student and graduate of the Harvard Law School. Those great teachers that we've had, from high school to Harvard, who have affected our lives, can and should be thought of as public treasures. If we can grant other people access to their wisdom, to their creativity, and to their enthusiasm, I think we will have done a great public service. Open access education offers more than an invitation to the public. It provides a forum for you, the enrolled students at the great universities. You get the chance to meet, in Second Life, this innovative, experimental, and boundless rhetorical space. And it's in this space that you will meet with students set on fire, classmates who are there for the sole purpose of learning and discussing the ideas of the class. We're not there for grades. We're there to talk to each other, to talk to you, and to learn from the experience. We're enthusiastic about inviting you to this classroom and in our second world, where we will be excited to give you feedback on your ideas from the perspective of the court of public opinion. You are members of an open access educational program, though it may not seem like it from the comfy chairs of Pound Hall. Make use of our presence. That is the value to you of the at-large community.
I want to start a revolution. The educational system has built a wall of apathy, disengagement, and disinterest between students and the joy of learning. This wall discourages students from interacting with the learning and from pursuing lifelong learning for fun. They're done with school. If we can use Cyber One methods and Second Life to find and engage at-large students to tear down that wall, we will have started my revolution. Won't you join us?
Cool. So, just a few comments before we get started on our projects here. We focus on empathic argument. I've been trying to learn what it is. What is it? I've learned a tremendous amount from you. I've come to the conclusion that as much as anything, it has to do with tone, with vibe, with the sense that you offer that you're actually speaking from the heart. That in and of itself is a key. And when I think about the Padilla video and the waterboard video, and think about the victims in that being as much the soldiers who carry out the approach to torture as close as it can get, as defined by an oppositional lawyer, I feel the opposite of the empathic sensibility. I feel confronted by a system that generates agents who will carry out the oppositional arguments. And I worry about you, lawyers going off. So I don't mean to spend too much with this at this point, but to be in touch with these kinds of thoughts at this point seems like a very good place to be, and delighted we've come this far. I'm hoping in my evidence class to do some of the teaching in Second Life in moot court environments and discussion environments. And without requiring or in any way making it conditional on anything, I would love to have some Cyber One group in some way affiliated with my evidence class, because I know I'm going to be teaching empathic argument as the core of it. I think I'll do it better, more efficiently, but it would be wonderful if there was some group that somehow was ahead on the subject, capable of modeling it. And I'm worried that we won't have time to really go through all your projects out here, and I'm looking for some way to do it into the future, at the same time responding to whatever my obligations are to the school. So I leave that as a kind of open thought. How are we doing on questions? Do we have any? No? Good. So now who's up? Are we ready? Who are our candidates for today? Okay. Come on down. Now, show me hands of people who have never spoken in the class. All right, well, today's your chance. Shall we put laptops down? Oh, yeah, a question tool. Yep, laptops up. So now we have to handle mics here. I'm not part of this act, right? It's just the two of you?
Yeah, just yes. The two of us.
Okay.
So maybe I'll just begin by introducing our project. I'm Jordan. This is Art. We were in 1L section together, and we've been friends for a long time. At the beginning of the year, I had still to complete my pro bono requirement, and I'd become a little bit concerned about how I was going to do that. And I know that Art is someone who has spent a lot of his time doing pro bono work, and we began to discuss it. And as we discussed it, the tenor of our conversations became a bit more heated. To some degree, I'd begun to resent the requirement, and I sort of channeled a lot of this Art's way. And the culmination was one argument that we had after this class, where I really began to feel that our friendship was almost in jeopardy or imperiled in some way. And so for our project, Art and I have discussed our different feelings about the pro bono requirement and tried to get clear with one another what exactly the issues were and why maybe that this was beginning to pose a problem for our friendship.
And we've done that on podcast. That's what makes it cyber. So it's not just us having a beer and then calling it a project. Although it's not terribly far from that either, in a way
that might have been as productive.
That might have been it. Well, so I guess this project is kind of different in that... great. This is so cool. I guess what makes this different from a lot of the other projects is this started out, maybe it started out as an attempt to make sort of some sort of public persuasive argument, but I think in the end it really became an exercise more in empathy between us.
Between the two of us.
So I think we have much less of an interest in this point. One of the things we sort of realized as we were talking through this was that neither of us cares all that much about the pro bono requirement as a pro bono requirement, right? It's, you know, 40 hours, you do it, it's done, you pay a lot of money and you graduate and life goes on. But for some reason, this had become sort of a focal point for us and we got really, really, really worked up about it. And we were trying to figure out kind of what was the underlying issue there. So I guess this is different in the sense that this isn't about us trying to start a campaign or a revolution or even really make any kind of policy change along the lines of the crosswalks or the anything else.
I mean, one way of putting it is that we're not really looking to empathize, although we wouldn't mind if we happened to, but it's not really about third parties. It's more about Art and I empathizing with one another.
I mean, I guess the public value that it has, that sounded kind of weird. I think the public value that it has maybe is in, I've been somewhat skeptical of this idea of empathic argument. I think it's great. I feel like I haven't seen it in actually happen a lot. And I think for us, this really felt like an example of something where this was really sort of happening. We were persuading each other and really also genuinely coming to see each other's perspective on this. And so we had sort of a series of very long conversations that we taped, and then we chopped them down into sort of relevant bits and cut out the garbage. How do your lessons in empathy translate to people who don't know you personally aren't third parties? The point. I mean, I guess that's the question that I'm answering right now, is that I feel like the value that this thing has is in sort of as an example of empathy in existence, but I don't know that it has value as sort of a persuasive point on the pro bono requirement.
So can I jump in?
Sure.
First, Jordan, tell us what exactly is the pro bono requirement?
The truth is I don't know exactly what it is. But, I mean, in broad outline, it says that you have to spend 40, I guess, hours of your time offering legal services or assisting other people in offering legal services for no pay.
And if you don't, you don't graduate.
And if you don't, you don't graduate.
And so you were a first-year student.
Yeah.
And you were aware of this.
Uh-huh.
And didn't fulfill it then.
Yeah.
Putting it off.
Uh-huh.
And you were a second-year student and aware of it then and putting it off.
Uh-huh.
And you come back at the beginning of your third year,
uh-huh,
and you're looking at, well, tell us how you felt at that
point. You know, I mean, you're looking at the clock, and it's ticking away, and you have other things to do. I was applying for jobs, and I was also trying to handle my coursework and get started on a 3L paper. And, you know, I guess more generally, trying to enjoy my 3L year, spending it with friends and going out and that sort of thing. And the truth was I didn't know how I was going to do these 40 hours, and I felt like I had to come up with a project quick or else maybe I'd be in some trouble.
But that makes it sound like it's just a matter of time. What I'm wondering is the fire in it? Did you feel it at some level of principle? Did you feel you were being violated by being told by the law school that you had to do 40 hours of good work?
Mm-hmm. I mean, not that I object to doing good work. Good work is obviously good, but, you know, I sympathize a little bit with what John was saying last class. You know, in terms of the libertarian line, the way I looked at it was, you know, time is one of the things I have. How would you feel if the law school said it as a condition on graduating, you have to take $500, whatever dollar amount, and spend it on a charity of your choosing. You'd say, that's ridiculous. My money's mine, and it's mine to do what I want with it. Well, I thought, well, time isn't really that much different. Why should the law school be able to reach into my back pocket, as it were, and tell me how I'm going to spend my time? So that was sort of the principle that got my goat.
This is an authority issue for you.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, where do they get off telling me I've got to do good work? If I'm going to do good work, I'm going to do it because I want to, not because they tell me to.
That's exactly right.
So art, empathize.
I mean, I hear that. I think one of the things we realized in
But wait, now, before you try okay. and empathize, all right, he actually had some... He got pissed.
Yeah.
And you got pissed at him.
Yeah.
Tell us why you got pissed at him.
Well, it took me a long time to really realize why. But I felt it more than I thought it. Which I think is kind of something that comes through a lot in you know, the conversations that we have in here. What it seems to me you've been talking about for most of this semester has been about getting people here rather than up here, right? We do all of our other classes. We work on getting them here. And I didn't know why, but I felt it, and I felt it really strongly. And I think one of the things that came out as we were having these conversations was that Jordan and I think both on a certain degree, felt a bit misled by certain aspects of the law school. And by certain aspects of our experience here. And that's a really bad feeling, to feel misled, to feel as though you've been lied to. And it kind of came out that in this conversation...
How did the law school mislead you?
I felt misled by the law school in the sense that I came here with a very sort of unclear idea of what it was that I wanted to do. And one of the reasons I came was I felt like law school was presented to me as essentially incredibly flexible, right? This is this incredibly flexible degree. People get law degrees and then go on to do a huge variety of different things. They write screenplays, they run businesses, they run nonprofit organizations, they become teachers, they become school principals. Nobody ever actually practices law with their law degrees, which is, you know, an exaggeration, but sort of a sentiment that I really got. And then I got here and decided that I didn't want to practice law and found almost no institutional support for that idea. And sort of in pursuing my own career, had to do a lot of kind of outside work on my own, which I was prepared to do, but which I felt like was not what had been suggested to me would happen. So I think that's the frustration that I felt. And I think that in the conversation that Jordan and I had, I saw in him something related to that. And that was what got my sort of bile up.
See, I don't get the connection.
Yeah.
I don't get the connection. I get, okay, the law school's misleading you, and then all of a sudden you're pissed at Jordan. But I don't get the therefore.
Well, it's, I mean, I think, you know, I don't think that it works as quite simply a therefore. I think that it's part and parcel of kind of the 3 years of our relationship and a whole lot of other issues that are going on with both of us. If you listen to the podcast, it'll be there. But I think that that's, you know, these things, the connections aren't necessarily immediately rational in these cases, right? This isn't a, I feel A, and so my response is B. I feel like that's the case.
Well, how about this? How about the general idea being you see me as a part of the constituency that Harvard favors to your detriment? That begins to get at it, right?
I think that's right. I think we talked about both of us feeling like kind of on the outside at a certain point.
Right. And in contrast to you, you see me as a bit of an insider. Is that right?
I think that's accurate. He's very good at this.
What?
They're suggesting that we listen to a podcast.
So we have it. So that's actually one of the things that we wanted to get from this. What we've done is we've got all of these podcasts. We haven't uploaded them yet. They still exist entirely sort of on my computer in Audacity. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to figure out what the best means of distributing them would be. So one thought we had was to just sort of put them up as links on the wiki. One thought we had was to somehow turn them into like MP3 tracks and burn them on a CD. with liner notes, I guess. I don't know. But I think one of the things we were hoping for were suggestions in that.
All right, the floor is open.
This isn't actually a suggestion about that, but it's interesting listening to you guys talk about this because it's hard to find the fight in your discussion. It's like you're so empathic to each other at this point. And so I was wondering whether maybe we could look at that, like the original video that you took or something that shows. I don't know. It's interesting to find that, like, you actually need the element of the dispute before the empathy seems useful.
We're going to watch this video.
Okay.
So while Professor Nesson is doing this, the backstory on this is that Jordan and I, a few months ago, went into Professor Nesson's office, or I guess a month ago, trying to figure out how to turn this into a project, and he videoed us discussing this, which is, I would say, raw and a little embarrassing right now. But apparently we're going to watch it. No, it's okay. Are you okay with it?
Oh, I'm fine.
We're okay with it.
When I told my grandmother I was on YouTube, you can imagine how proud.
I'm confused.
I'm confused. Thank you.
I'm providing legal services before spring break if you're going to graduate from Harvard Law School.
And so Jordan and I began to talk about this informally because, you know, we're friends, we're having a beer, we're having dinner, and there was something about your resistance to this that really bothered me, in a very sort of deep and visceral way. We went through all of the sort of legal arguments about, you know, or practical arguments about why we have this, right? Is it to expose law students in, you know, an otherwise kind of corporate-oriented environment to something different in the hopes that, you know, they might gain some meaningful experience out of it, you know, if not actually go into some sort of pro bono practice, at least have a meaningful pro bono experience here. And we talked about that. And we talked about the connection between the pro bono requirement here and the pro bono practice of most state bars, right, the requirements there. And we talked about you know, this idea that Harvard's a big institution and it's a wealthy institution and there's a lot of privilege floating around here. We have sort of an ability by virtue of the fact that we're Harvard, and maybe it's a fairly small thing to, you know, to channel a sliver of that resource into some sort of do-gooding thing. But at the end of the day, the legal arguments, the rational arguments, I don't think were what was driving me so hard, and certainly weren't what was ultimately kind of churning at both of us and you know, putting our friendship, if not at risk, certainly in a state of abeyance, perhaps.
One of the things that really surprised me about that conversation is that, in retrospect, and probably even at the time, I realized that my griping about the pro bono requirement to you was sort of aggressive, but maybe not totally. I didn't really think that I'd cross any major lines in complaining to you. So sort of, but not very. And then when we're having that conversation outside, I realized, correct me if I'm wrong, I realized that I thought you were really angry at me. And maybe you had every right to be that angry at me, but it was surprising to me. I didn't, up until that moment when I saw it, I didn't realize just how much I was pushing your buttons. And when I did, I was really sort of taken aback by it.
Yeah. I mean, I think when I'm at my most honest, it did press my buttons. And I've been, so what I've been trying to do is figure out why was that?
Yeah.
Right? Because, you know, we both have friends who are, you know, I don't know that we're exactly on the same side of the political spectrum, and we certainly have friends who are farther afield from both of us than we are from each other. And we, you know, debate all sorts of things. We go to law school, you know, we debate all kinds of policy issues, and then, you know, we step away from it, and it's over. And we go on to the next thing. And for some reason, you know, that was not the case here. And so I've been trying to figure out also why that was. And I think, you know, I may still even just be coming to realize it now. I think for me, a part of this has been about the way the values that I feel Harvard has and the ways in which I don't connect with those values.
But, I mean, we both, to use Professor Nesson's term, see ourselves as rebelling in some way.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Against the culture that doesn't, that prizes corporate law, and that pushes people toward, you know, Wall Street, or how you'd like to describe it. And I see myself as rebelling against a rule, or a rule which has been created by, I guess, the administration or whoever, that would have me conform to something that I don't feel like conforming to. So in that way, there's kind of a symmetry.
Yeah.
So I guess when we decided to do the project, sit back there, Shannon. This way, I guess one of the hopes was that somehow the issues that Art and I were thinking about and sort of debating with one another, and that led to this heated kind of confrontation between us, that somehow those would be issues that other people in their own different way, but hopefully in a way that's related, that you'd work through too, that would resonate with you, that if it's not the pro bono requirement, then maybe it's some other aspect of Harvard Law School that leaves you feeling alienated or marginalized, and that maybe this would be something which for you has played a role or surfaced in conversations or friendships or things like that. So I don't know. In that way, does this project seem like it could be successful, or does it do that for you? Do you hear this and you think, oh, this is kind of like, you know, something that...
Well, I have a response more directly to the pro bono requirement rather than a comparable experience of my own, but I just have a suggestion, which is that you talk to Jean Charn, who's teaching, I'm taking her class on delivery of legal services, and she talks a lot about the development of the pro bono requirement and how it was very controversial and how it's possible to fulfill the requirement by doing, like, summer public interest work abroad for which you actually get paid. That's how I did it. I got paid to go work in Sudan, and I actually, like, had money left over at the end of the summer, and so it was very much not pro bono. I, like, profited from the experience, and it fulfilled. So there were controversies along those lines, too, which are, I think, sound relevant to your project.
I think I have one question for you guys. Like, in your series of podcasts, did you break it down by an issue, or how did you break down the podcast?
They were freestyle.
Okay.
What we realized was that, you know, we would sort of start talking about one thing. We would start talking specifically about the pro bono requirement, and that would lead us to one place, and then that would lead us to another place, which would lead us to another place.
Because it's hard to keep it discreet.
It's hard to keep it discreet. It's also, I think, in some ways, you know, that's what happens when you're on the web, right? You know, you click on a link, and that takes you to a different link, and that takes you to this blog, and that takes you to this whatever. So, do they kiss in the end?
well, I mean...
I just to answer your question, Allison, I don't... you know, we broke it down basically okay. kind of by the time. We're going to sort of try to isolate which issue is in which discussion.
Okay, because I think, like, I wouldn't want to go on, like, if you organize them all on a website or something of that nature, which I can definitely see happening, and if you kind of summarize them, that would be helpful. But also, like, I wouldn't want to just click on them and listen endlessly. I would want them to be have some direction. And I also would wonder, could you put something about either something controversial that led to the, you know, like Professor Charn saying it was controversial, or even a heated argument between you guys to open up the dynamics? Because I still kind of feel like you guys are very far along in your empathy. And so to get a draw or to get a starting point to have some sort of definite friction.
And in terms, just a suggestion for a zone of conflict from which you could start, I mean, it's been very controversial whether or not the ABA should require lawyers to do a certain amount of pro bono every year. And different, some, I mean, it varies by state, but I think it's very rare. And that's an extremely controversial thing, that there's a lot of information on. So that might be something interesting.
Can I jump in one more time? We'll just pass it back and forth. But I also am interested in knowing, do you see your project as being something to which, like, law students could relate, or to which an audience could relate and learn from your development of empathy, or whether you see it more focused on the pro bono? Because I kind of thought it was the former, like you want it to be, or you see it as being translatable into a broader, like, people can learn from this? Or, I mean, I think that depends on the perspective or the slant you want to take.
Yeah, I mean, I think it started out as the latter and it wound up as the former. I think that it started off as a real discussion about the pro bono requirement, and it has emerged into much more about trying to empathize with someone on a different, sort of on the other side of a particular issue. Pro bono just happens to be the thing that's sitting there. For me, at least.
Yeah, well, this is a question for Jordan, which is that the law school requires us to do all kinds of things. I mean, our first year curriculum has pretty much no leeway. There's a lot of kind of semi-required courses in the second and third year. There's the writing requirement. What about the pro bono? Is that requirement is different from the other ones, in your opinion?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I mean, in some ways, my claim is that the pro bono requirement is especially objectionable because it's not neutral. And you say, well, none of the law school curriculum is neutral anyways, so why single out this piece as especially objectionable? I don't really have an answer to that. I mean, I know that when Art and I were discussing this initially, that was the first point he made, and in some ways it's, you know, I mean, it's that's the obvious response. I mean, I guess what I sort of feel is that, look, Harvard Law School, we all come here because we want the basic tools that you need to be a lawyer. And, you know, that involves contract law, civ pro, criminal law, and the other required classes. The 3L paper requirement, I think, is sort of silly, so you could get rid of that. But and then I felt like this pro bono thing, it's not really there because people believe it's somehow especially necessary for your development as a lawyer. I mean, it's there because someone made a decision at a level that here's the kind of thing that lawyers ought to be doing. They ought to be going out into the community. They ought to be volunteering their time. And we're going to require that not because it's educationally necessary, but because we think it's a good thing. And I guess that's what kind of got my goat. I'm sure you could press on that in some way that again made it seem less distinguishable from other aspects of the curriculum. But I also bet that resonates, that response doesn't strike you as totally artificial either.
All right, so tell us the email to which you would like feedback sent.
jmbleicher, that's B-L-E-I-C-H-E-R, at gmail.com.
We got that? And the form of critique that I recommend to you, not just for this purpose, but for purposes of critique wherever you come upon it, is articulate the strong points and then suggest some way that something could be improved. All right, and KB's question here is a real good one.
Oh, what is it? Oh.
Professor Nesson, everyone wants a fight, not empathy. Empathy is boring. What do you say to that?
That's not mine.
That's not yours. That's anonymous. All right, so...
So am I supposed to
No,
say
I don't think
or?
That's up to you. Oh. I think that's a question to me. Here's what I say to that. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, guys. All right, we got a tape change. Okay. In some ways, the plaintiff's lawyer has a very privileged place in litigation. Why? Because the plaintiff's lawyer chooses the case that the plaintiff's lawyer wants to litigate and chooses from, if they're successful, a wide selection so that the plaintiff's lawyer has the opportunity to choose what truth he or she wants to advance. The technique that the best of the plaintiff's lawyers will follow is that they will choose a truth they can really stand behind. It's not a matter of faking something up. It's a matter of finding a real case that you can go with. And then the trick is to articulate in terms of a cause of action. And at the same time you do that, think through all the way to the end of the process, to the jury instructions and the verdict form, which will mirror the cause of action, and then fill in between with evidence. And the lawyer who expresses faith in the neutrality of the process, that is, the lawyer who is seen to be a neutral messenger of the truth, is the most credible lawyer in the room. So that in many ways the contest between the lawyers becomes a contest to see which abuses the truth least. And this works its way all the way through the actual practice of the trial. So a lawyer who is confronting an adverse witness, and the witness somehow wants to take advantage by jumping to some point that's thought to be damaging, lawyers will see that not as something threatening, but as an opportunity. An opportunity to slow things down, explore with the witness why they didn't answer the question that you asked, why they sought to rush off to another one. And in the process of showing that, we'll demonstrate that the witness is not neutral to the truth. The witness is biased. And the lawyer, on the other hand, who is best able to lay out in a way that needn't be naive, but can be thorough, can take away the hit that comes from the other side. So that in some ways, empathy is a winning strategy in the courtroom. the lawyer who's oppositional up against the lawyer who is empathetic, I would put my money on the empathic lawyer every time. Assuming the lawyer's going to be good. It's not just a matter of being sappy. But it is definitely a matter of not being seen to take advantage. And the way you're not seen to take advantage best is by being the first mover in showing the strengths and weaknesses of your case. So it's maybe not the most interesting. I agree with you. On television, you get the McLaughlin report, and you get, it's like fight, 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 and it gets to a point where it's just a bunch of junk. But if you're actually trying to persuade someone, then the idea that you are a persuasive person in the sense of honoring the system by the way you present so that people who agree with you are themselves honoring the system. It's in that sense that you have the opportunity to be the law yourself and to encourage the other participants in the process to be the law. If you put yourself in the mind of a juror and you ask, how do you decide? Who do you decide for? Who do you trust most in the courtroom? You're going to trust the person who's the master of empathic argument long before you're going to trust the person who's oppositional. The person who is speaking empathically has his heart in it. The oppositional character just has the knives out. So I think it's got utility. All right, who's up next? Come, go. Can we clear this somehow, sweetie? It'll come up. Okay.
Apparently not. It shouldn't be case sensitive, should it?
No, it can't be case sensitive.
Horses?
Well, either way, it's not a big deal because there's not much up there yet anyway, but I was just going to show what was there. But we'll just forget about that and just leave the lovely live questions alone. Yeah. Okay, I was going to try and pull up my website because I got it up and working. It was my major accomplishment was getting the FTP thing working, which I was quite proud of. And so I was going to show you what essentially was a page with a few tabs and not a whole lot of content yet. But essentially, I'll start talking about my issue a little bit and then sort of where I'm going with my project as sort of background from there. And so the issue I decided to sort of look at was something that sort of grew in response to a couple of different things. The first was Proposition 1 in this last election, which was the whole thing about selling wine in grocery stores, which to me seems like the most obvious thing in the world. But apparently to the residents of the state of Massachusetts, the majority of whom voted against this proposition didn't make a lot of sense. And I sort of looked at that and...
Hang a sec.
Oh, yeah.
This was a proposition to permit it or prevent it?
A proposition to permit it, yeah. In the state of Massachusetts... a single entity is only allowed a certain number of liquor licenses in the state. So if you're Shaw's, you're allowed, I don't know what the number is, like 2 liquor licenses in the whole state. So you can pick 2 of your grocery stores to sell wine at, and you can't sell at any of the others. I've never lived in a state or anywhere else like that. And so I just thought
you mean in the states you've lived in, it's just liquor all over the place?
Pretty much. Well, wine all over the place, certainly. In Arizona and Illinois and North Carolina. In North Carolina, you have to buy your hard liquor from a state-controlled liquor store. But certainly you can buy wine everywhere. And so that sort of got me thinking about the issue, and then also got me looking at what ultimately sort of became the idea of my project, because it's a little more internet-related, is the idea of buying wine over the internet and whether or not you can ship it into certain states. And it's also an interesting to me because it was an interesting legal case a couple of years ago about whether or not it's a Commerce Clause violation about letting wineries ship. And to skip over the boring legal mumbo-jumbo, the short end of the story is you have to treat in-state wineries the same way you treat out-of-state wineries. And so in Massachusetts, the law is that if you are a winery that produces less than 30,000 gallons a year, you can ship directly. And if you produce more than 30,000 gallons a year, you can't. The entertaining little caveat there being that no winery in the state of Massachusetts produces more than 30,000 gallons a year. So legally, this is currently being litigated by a whole bunch of different both consumer advocacy groups as well as all the various industry groups on both sides of the issue. The winemakers suing to get the law struck down, the wholesalers suing each other. So that's not all very interesting. But the part that's really interesting to me about this whole thing is that the general public doesn't really seem to know or care at all about what's going on here. So I wanted to try to find a way to sort of my position, of course, is that these laws are kind of silly and that, you know, we should just be kind of allowed to sort of buy and trade and ship things freely. But it seemed to me, particularly from the way that the question one worked out in the state of Massachusetts, is that this is going to be fun here in a second, is that that doesn't necessarily matter and be all that entertaining to people. You can have the various groups run their ads that are all like, oh my God, everyone's going to die in drunk driving if people can buy wine at grocery stores, or nothing's going to happen. So what I want to do is try and look at the issue and try and find a sort of entertaining way of looking at the issue just to sort of raise awareness. And so when I did my podcast, I first did one that was sort of serious and not very interesting. And so I scratched that and then did a second one that I thought was a little bit more humorous, where I sort of made this analogy to the Boston Tea Party. And, you know, what would you know the Bostonians of old have done with these sort of regulations on trade and drink? And so for my project, what I thought I would look at is try and make a game about freeing the grapes and make it into a game as just sort of a way to try and raise awareness about the issue. And being a fan of old classic movies, I thought I'd call it The Grape Escape, which was also a board game back in like the 80s, if anybody remembers that as well, with like little Play-Doh grapes that you made. But I decided I'd steal their name anyway, since The Grape Escape is also the name of like 1,000 different wine stores and tours all over the place. So I figured I was pretty okay going with that name. So that was that's sort of where I am right now. I've got a little website which you can't seem to get to, which ultimately is going to host the game and also has some links where once people have sort of played the game, they can learn more about the issue, and providing some links to both people in favor of the restrictions and people against the restrictions. And so the idea is trying to use this game as a tool to just sort of raise awareness, really, because I feel like people will understand my position once they know really what's going on, but that nobody knows, and that I need to provide a way to sort of get people to care. And I thought a game would be a relatively entertaining way of doing that. So I'll take a look at the questions here. Law school crushes, that's about other stuff. I don't think this crushes spirit. So I'll actually take this Joe Camel one, because that's one that I've been thinking about, and so it's pretty interesting, even though it has no votes. But it was just submitted, because that's why it's red, right? That's what that means? I don't know where it went. It might have moved up to the top. things move around. Oh, there it is, right there. Oh, yeah, here we go. Making a game to promote more alcohol sales. Aren't video games designed to appeal to kids? What would Joe Camel say? That's an interesting point. And it's something that I sort of started thinking about more after I got... I thought the idea just came to me that wouldn't a game be interesting and fun and sort of a way to raise awareness, particularly on the internet. And then, of course, there is the issue that a lot of people on the internet are under 21. And... the question is whether or not... To me, the question is whether or not the game promotes alcohol consumption. And in my mind, at least, it doesn't promote alcohol consumption. It just promotes awareness and just sort of talks about how restrictions and sales on trade are just kind of silly, and that, you know, our legislature should be spending their time a little more productively. But it's definitely a valid critique of the project. And if anybody has a comment on perhaps a intelligent way to sort of address that, I'd be happy to hear it. I'll just, if anyone wants to raise their hands, that's cool. If not, I'm just going to keep reading off of this thing because I think, okay, there we go.
Pass back.
So I can actually see what's going on without having to turn around.
I guess I would ask, are games for kids anymore? Like, there are so many people over 21 that play video games right now that that doesn't even seem to be an issue. I don't know. I mean,
I certainly agree with you. I know I play a lot of video games still, and I'm over 21.
And a suggestion, I think you should make it a driving game where you try and go to grocery stores and pick up... pick up wine. Just push it as, you know, make it as ludicrous as possible.
That's not a bad idea. I was also thinking on playing like a fence and like having to take a little motorcycle and drive it over the fence to escape, to sort of as a homage to the great Steve McQueen scene at the end of The Great Escape, the movie. That's also a good idea. Right now the idea is I sort of have some little stages is the idea for the game, so I could probably make that a stage. As it were, if people are particularly intrigued by that.
So I get the impression that you stop at the grocery store, you get the alcohol, and then you drive away and you have a wreck. Is that the idea?
Or maybe the idea would be you could have two modes. Like there's the you can only get wine at a liquor store mode, and then there's like hyper mode where all the grocery stores are enabled, and you can, you know, pick your wine up at the grocery store and get, you know, I don't know.
Well, one of the things that was interesting to me as you spoke was one of the podcasts that we had. Who made the podcast? Was it? Maybe I could find it. We had a podcast on this subject, which started in a very interesting way. Who made it? Was it made by someone in here? With the sirens and, yeah, exactly.
Car wreck.
Right. I don't know, we have so many up here now, it's hard to find them. Oh, I know where I could find it. Where's the empathy?
That's a good question. It's a very good question. It goes along with my whole problem of I'm not quite sure I understand exactly what empathy is. So the way I at least understand this, and I guess Professor Nesson, feel free to break in at any point if I am misconstruing the idea of empathy. But it seems to me that the idea is to, as you were talking about earlier today, establish credibility with your audience. And empathy doesn't have to be necessarily, in my mind, necessarily establishing sort of understanding of your opponent. I don't know if I buy that empathy has to involve that. I think the important thing is looking at who you want to persuade. And sometimes, in a lot of situations, like in a negotiation, that is your sort of opponent across the table. But in a public policy setting, I think the person that you're trying to be credible with is the just general population at large. And so so I would say the empathy sort of just comes in trying to sort of have a disarming way of looking at this issue. And I think that sort of games and comedy and everything can be sort of very disarming tools. And that then when you present that as sort of a way to disarm people, and then when it comes to sort of the substantive area of the site, present both sides of the issue. Present, you know, clearly the game is going, has an opinion, which is mine, which is that these laws are silly.
And so you play the game and you have a good time and maybe you have a laugh and say, okay, wasn't that fun? And then the idea is people click around on the site, they learn a little bit more about the real issue. And in that part, presenting both sides of the case, I think, is important. So I'm not quite sure if that necessarily addresses the idea of empathy completely. But my understanding of empathy is really about sort of just credibility with the group you're trying to persuade, not necessarily with understanding your opponent, so to speak.
So one of the things that frustrates me a lot as a voter in Massachusetts mm-hmm. is how hard it is to get good information about these questions that are on the ballots. They're phrased in these totally weird and confusing ways, and everybody who advocates one side or the other seems to really act as if there is only one side or the other.
Yeah, there was like the question that was like evil. For kids, and I never quite figured out which side was for kids and which side wasn't for kids. Does anybody else remember that question in the ads on TV? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so
just an example.
Just as a sort of a basic explanation of why it's useful to state both sides, in order to gain credibility with me, somebody trying to convince me to vote on one of those propositions needs to tell me what the strong arguments are for the other side.
So I guess, did we find what we were looking for there?
Well, I did, and...
We can just go ahead and...
Just to hit it.
It's not mine, but it sounds Patrick interesting.
Burks, Patrolman Swift here. I'm in. This is Officer Culpepper out here on Hungerhall Road. Just wanted to give you an update on the accident scene. We've got 3 confirmed deceased. We're just removing the bodies now. We do have 1 survivor. The girl landed in the bushes. Looks like she's going to make it. We'll be met back in her very soon. But she has been speaking, and I wanted to give you an update. Looks like one of their older friends bought some wine for them down at Shoney's Market and went too fast. They never made the curve down here. Yeah, we've got quite a mess on our hands here. It's a sad picture. You know the story. Over and out. You do know the story.
That's like... The basic argument that, or maybe it's, I don't know which way it goes, but basically the argument is you put the stuff in all the grocery stores, it makes it much easier for the kids to get it. The easier it is for the kids to get it, the more drunk driving accidents you have. So protect our kids and vote whatever the way it was on proposition whatever. Mm-hmm. That's the position that empathize with that.
Right, okay, so that's the position on proposition 1. The issue I'm looking at specifically, direct sales, is a slightly different issue because it's not in stores readily available. It's about buying over the internet and getting it shipped to you. The argument there, I think, I can understand how you would be worried about your kids buying wine over the internet and then getting it shipped directly to them. My only problem there is that, I understand that you're worried about your kids, but... If you're worried about your kids getting alcohol, buying it over the internet, paying with a credit card, getting it shipped through the mail, as much as I know about underage drinking, I don't know if people think that far ahead in planning to drink a nice, small bottling of Pinot Noir for to go get hammered on a Saturday night. But as to question 1, I think you have a point, and we certainly should be worried about our kids and worried about drunk driving and what's going to happen. I can't deny that that's important. But on the same hand, choice is important, and the empirical evidence that we do have from all the states that allow these sales don't show any sort of escalation in the driving rates. And we certainly could act with an overabundance of caution. And I suppose that certainly is a permissible outcome for people through their legislatures to take. I suppose if that's what the people really want, then that's fine. I just feel like at this point there is no honest conversation, and that I at least have faith that once people fully understand the issues that the polis will vote otherwise. I guess would be my response to you on that.
All right. What's the email address to which you would like your feedback sent?
My Harvard email is fine. K Parker, K P A R K E R. It's about as simple as you can get at law.harvard.edu.
All right. So. Thank you very much. All right. Who's up? Come on. Come on down.
Hi, so my name is Manoj Ramachandran, and my project is about libertarianism, and I'm actually working with John about it, but since...
Hold the mic up.
Oh, sorry. My apologies. Since time is kind of limited, I thought maybe we could just discuss two of the issues that I feel are pretty important to me. The first is intellectual property protection. To some degree, and to a large degree, I feel it should not exist in countries where it does not benefit them. So, for example, why should third world countries like Africa recognize patents that prevent them from making their own HIV drugs? Same with India. Why should countries like Sweden pay money to import American movies when they really pretty much don't have to? And the answer is because the United States threatens them with trade sanctions and revocation of aid. And there's basically, I think we're in a regime right now where there's a kind of a first mover problem. So the first person to break this kind of rule will decimate pretty much the intellectual property sphere. Imagine like Sweden revokes intellectual property protection and becomes legal to host, let's say, non-Swedish or even all sorts of music on their internet sites, and it'll be free for download in the United States. So we kind of use disproportionate force to prevent them from doing that. And the reason we do so is because the corporate interests have just become so strong. So, for example, in the earliest, when America was created, there was copyright protection was like 14 years for a book. And a book sold to like 1/100th as many people. So now that when I write a book, I sell it to like 1,000 times as many people, wouldn't you think that I need like 1/1,000th of the time limit protection-wise? And while there are counter-arguments, for example, like marketing has gone up, et cetera, I'm not sure that that's sufficient. Instead, we see these rent-seeking behaviors of the corporations to try and lobby for a longer and longer copyright statute, whereas for all intents and purposes for the last 20 years, this might as well have been perpetual. And
so who's your audience? Who are you trying to persuade?
I think I'm trying to persuade, and this is kind of bizarre, non-Americans, because Americans likely benefit from copyright protection rules because it encourages exports. So maybe poor countries, so India, Africa, things like that with respect to pharmaceuticals. And maybe I have my hopes pinned on the Swedish, actually, for copyright. So for movies, music, and things like that. I'm trying to persuade kind of them. But I think overall I'm just trying to persuade the populace in general that countries, your government should not force you or to obey this kind of intellectual property regime when it's not really in your best interest.
But suppose they agree with you. They say, yes, we understand this is not in our best interests. Left free to our own devices, of course, we wouldn't do this because the net effect is a whole bunch of money goes out from our country to a richer country, and it's not in our interest, except for the fact that it's made to be in our interest by very powerful countries doing potentially very nasty things to us if we don't go along with this. And in the hierarchy of values, this isn't that important to us. We'd just as soon knuckle under to American copyright and get U.S. aid and U.S. security and U.S. whatever we're getting from them, U.S. trade.
And I think to answer that question, I would respond that first, that hopefully in my mind, and I'm not sure this is true because I'm not an economist, I think it's a kind of, as I said before, a first mover problem, whereas if one country breaks the line or like the wall of silence or whatever it is, and then hopefully others will follow. So for the marginal second country, it'll be, so you're kind of making it easier for your neighbor. And the second thing that I would say is that there are multiple ways to accomplish this goal. So for example, it's not only, you can not only repeal the law, you can kind of institute a regime of non-enforcement. And to some degree, China and Russia have been doing this with respect to software.
All right. Questions, suggestions, Renata? Yep. Thank you. Right there.
Yeah. Well, I think it would be really effective if you focus it on health, like pharmaceuticals, because there is like a health issue that is very easy to defend. But if you make it really broad to copyright issues in general, there's an issue like in Colombia that American pharmaceuticals are coming to the jungle in Colombia to get the jahe, for example, to patent it and to have a copyright on that. So if you have an argument like you cannot have copyright rights, then we in Latin America or in the third world in general cannot claim copyrights to our own resources. So I don't know how you're going to deal with that issue of, you know, because now the big battle now is going to be how they are going to copyright our own resources.
I'm not convinced that you're going to be able to make much leeway with these countries, because it seems to me that if they thought this wasn't in their best interest, they already wouldn't do it, like China, which doesn't really respect intellectual property, but India has a large native production of intellectual property and software, and so they do enforce the laws and benefit from them themselves. So I think it's going to – how would you bridge that gap?
To answer the first question about the Latin American patent rights, I would say that it's very difficult to give without receiving. And so I would say not only could they not patent it, you wouldn't be able to patent it either. And I think that would be beneficial for everyone, because I think copyrights and patents in this example, so pharmaceuticals, are one of the rare examples of a public good where you have that's kind of pseudo-privatized, where you accord someone a right to exclude. That's kind of artificially enforced by the government. And instead of doing that, I would change it to a more like either subsidized research regime or let it be totally privatized, where I think Coase might have stated that if transaction costs are sufficiently low, people with like-minded ideals will come together to pay for these things. And with regard to the second question about how the difference between kind of China and India and how these countries aren't going to do this, I think it's in no country's best interest right now. It's probably not even in China's, because of all the pressure that they're getting, especially Russia is getting a lot of pressure. But my point is it's not in their best interest because of the regime. It's because America is expropriating these kind of artificial factors related to sanction and foreign aid into the equation. So I think we really need to kind of stop that. And because we're kind of importing, it's basically we're using disproportionate force that we have no right to use. Why should we revoke a country's kind of aid for example, like HIV or some like infant mortality, because they're not respecting copyright things. And I think this is a regime that the federal government has increasingly got into, especially with regard to even the different states in the union. Oh, you. Here we go.
Yeah, well, if it's American law and American policy that's responsible for this, then shouldn't you be empathizing with Americans in this issue?
I guess I am empathizing with Americans to some degree, but on a more, I guess, with the rest of the world, I empathize in a kind of utilitarian way, where you should do this because it's really best for you, and although you'll take some sanctions in the short run, they won't last, and you'll get all these drugs and medicines that'll make your life a lot better. With respect to the Americans, I empathize in a more kind of very libertarian way, where, this is not fair. People should be free to kind of do this sort of thing, And by kind of giving this right to the content holders, a right that they shouldn't have, you're kind of making it worse for everyone. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Okay. I wasn't sure if you were going to the question tool or... I'll just go ahead. So I understand what you're saying. I'm just sort of confused about the, you know, sort of the result that we're trying to get here. Because you say the regime is too strict, but and you also say, wouldn't it be great if somebody like Sweden or somebody else just abolished the regime? And I feel like with that kind of a position, you know, that's open to a lot of backlash. Compared to trying to say, instead of sort of tuning it, and maybe I'm just not understanding what you're saying, but sort of tuning it in a way of saying the system as it is unreasonable. We need to make the system reasonable. We need to give some reasonable protections to copyright holders, but then say protections we have right now are, you know, not reasonable or something. Maybe I'm not understanding.
Well, that's
your position.
That's a kind of different way of looking at it. What I'm saying is that, you know, like just like the states are a kind of hotbed for testing things, everyone advocates for some sort of reasonable compromise with respect to copyright. But my feeling is that will never, ever, ever happen. The reason is because these copyright holders have these rent-seeking behaviors, and they basically control the Congress with their donations. What I'm saying is maybe not abolish it everywhere, but in some countries, abolish it and see what happens. And there are countries where you can abolish it, where it would clearly be beneficial for them. And maybe we should like kind of look at this experiment and see where it leads. And in some sense, like with Professor Fried's like modern liberty, I think it's kind of relevant because in some way, we're building up this kind of intellectual property pyramid, this great kind of eighth wonder of the world in America, where we have all this kind of information and knowledge in the internet, and we're doing it on the backs of kind of almost wage slavery. But it's not really wage slavery. It's just kind of like we're, instead of forcing like 10 people to slave away to build this, we're forcing like 10 million to, we're garnishing their paychecks and then building this empire because an oligarchical minority thinks it's good.
All right, what's the web? What's the email address that you would like your critique sent to?
No, these are going to be good. my name is extremely long, so it's mramachandran at law.harvard.edu.
Here, let's somehow get it up there.
Letter ad, so I can avoid the spam bots.
Where is it? It went away. Oh, it's... Yes.
I'll give myself a vote.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right, so that's it for today. Who's up for tomorrow? Richard's the only one we've got? Two? Three? Four? All right. You're in line. We're heading for tomorrow. See you tomorrow. Thank you.